Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is singer-songwriter Pamela McNeil. McNeil issued the six-song EP Wave After Wave earlier this year on the Farm to Label imprint. In this conversation, McNeil recalls her early passion for music, singing backup vocals for pop superstar Rick Astley, and co-writing material with New Age music legend Yanni. That's on Into Music, coming up now. When did you become aware of music?
Well, really, really young. There was always music in my house growing up, and my mom and dad both always had music on. And I loved it immediately. I mean, I just took to it like water, you know, like a duck to water. So I don't even know. It probably was just, again, all around me, the radio, records, church, whatever. But I was 3 years old when I decided I wanted to be a singer. So, yeah.
Tell me about that.
So I was dressed up as an angel on Christmas Eve with a little tinsel halo in my hair and went up to sing with all the little kids, you know, the Christmas Eve service at church. And I looked out and I saw all these beaming, happy faces. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be right here. So I decided from the age of three, I was going to be a singer. And people would say, oh, she'll change her mind, or maybe you want to be a nurse or whatever. And I was like, no, I want to be a singer. And I just made it happen.
Did you grow up in Winona?
Yes. Very good. Winona, Minnesota, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with that part of Minnesota.
Yeah.
The southeast corner right on the Mississippi River. Yeah. It's beautiful. I mean, it's a gorgeous city. Just there's bluffs and there's river and lakes. And it's stunning.
Obviously, there's a long history of music in Minnesota, but a lot of it is coming out of Duluth or Minneapolis. So if you're running around telling people in Winona, I'm going to be a singer, yeah. How's that met?
I was the crazy one. No, I don't know. I just, you know, when I got a little bit older, like 15, 16, there was a really popular club in town called the Mississippi Queen. And all of the big cover bands from the Twin Cities would play there. And the owners knew I wanted to be a singer or whatever. And I wasn't of age, but they'd let me in and I would have my Diet Coke and I'd sit there and I'd just watch them. And I'd be like, okay, this is what I'm, you know, it was like training. It was like, you know, school, like, how does this work and whatever. So kind of everybody knew that I was, you know, I was a musician. I mean, I started playing piano. I played trombone. I was in everything you could be in, you know, in high school, at church, or, you know, whatever. So, and then I started singing in my first rock band at 16. It's kind of just what I became, you know, I just made it happen.
Everybody was kind of in on it. It was like, that's her thing. We're just going to let her go. That's amazing. Yeah. So your teachers probably saw that you had some aptitude and you mentioned singing in a band. So did you, you know, by 16, when you're starting off in a band, did you kind of have a plan in place of like, I'm going to do this for a while and then go to New York or whatever?
I didn't really have the means growing up. Like, we didn't have like a lot of money or connections or anything like that. So I just knew it would happen. I just wasn't sure how, but I made a rule with myself that everything that I did would always be a step up. Like, whatever the next thing would be another step forward in the direction I wanted to go, wherever that might be. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, I really wanted to go to Juilliard and study classical piano and sing, you know, but that was not in the cards because it was super expensive, you know, and stuff, and just wasn't going to happen. I just knew that eventually it would be, it was going to take me somewhere. I just wasn't sure exactly what that was. So I just kind of kept, you know, forward motion, so to speak.
I'm curious about singing in the band, because it's evident to me that as a singer, you don't hold anything back. And so I'm wondering if some of that came from, you know, playing in clubs and like, you need to have people's attention.
That's a really interesting observation. Well, I had, okay, so I will just tell you that, like in the fifth grade, when our band director, that's when you start choosing your instrument for a band, right? I wanted to play flute. And I walked in and the band director said, you got a good set of lungs, you're going to play trombone. So I had just this, I could belt it out. I just was one of those people who could, it just was in me for whatever reason. And so I, you know, and my heroes, like the people I've studied that I wanted to sing like, I mean, I had pictures of Steve Perry on my wall, and I had Pat Benatar was like my guru, and Stevie Nicks and Ann Wilson. And like, I wanted to just, it's kind of where I put all my emotion. It just all came out there. So it makes sense what you say. I mean, you know, it's just, if you want to be a rock and roll singer, then you have to be a rock and roll singer, you know, kind of thing. So, so yeah, I've just always had that energy and that, for whatever reason, just that power behind what I do. Although I can do the soft stuff too, but because I can, people always want me to. So I, you know, a lot of the different things I've done through my life, I always get those songs. I just get the out front ones, I call them, you know. So, but that's an interesting observation.
At what point did you kind of start writing your own stuff? Was this also happening like very early on?
So I always was making up little melodies and stuff and writing poetry and all that. And I didn't really realize, you know, it was a different time when I grew up. So it wasn't like today, everybody knows Taylor Swift wrote her songs and people can write their songs or whatever, but it was sort of like, it was a lot more mystical and mysterious back then. So people would, you know, you'd pore over the liner notes to find out anything. It wasn't like you saw them on social media every day. So I really wasn't aware that you could really write your own songs until I was about in high school. And there was a talent show and I was 15, but I was a sophomore, and there was a talent show coming up, and I just thought, you know what, I'm going to write a song and do it. I don't know why I thought I could. I mean, I played piano and could play it by ear and stuff like that, but I'm like, I want to write a song. So it got to be a couple days before, and I was like, oh, I guess I better write this song. So I did a song called Wanting You. And I recruited a senior, Kari Von Groven, who I thought had the most beautiful voice. She was a soprano, and I did the alto part. And we learned it, and we performed it at the talent show. And when we were done, the whole place stood up. I mean, it was like, what? You know? And then after that, I would write these songs, and the girls would stand around my piano at the school and just cry and whatever. And I was like, I must be onto something here. So then I realized that most people that I respected or knew or whatever I was learning was like, you really need to write your own songs if you're gonna, you know, but that again, that's another way to make an income stream, although I didn't call it an income stream back then, but you know, and so then I really loved it. I was like, okay, I want more of this. How do I do this? So I studied songs and, you know, did all that, but it was just sort of a natural progression that just sort of worked itself out, if that makes sense. And then it comes pretty easily to me, actually. I love it.
You mentioned this idea of kind of moving up one step along the way. So what was kind of the breakthrough moment for you, you know, for in terms of performance and writing and everything?
Well, I would say there was a couple of really significant steps. One was when I was on the road with a cover band. I was performing in this club. I think I was 19. And there's a couple people in the audience who, one of them was a backing singer for a really big regional band called Lamont Cranston. They were a huge blues band. They had like a hit and everybody loved them. It was the kind of band that like Bonnie Raitt would stop by to sing with and all this. Anyway, one of their backing singers had just left and they approached me and said, do you have any interest in, you know, maybe, you know, having this job, you know, singing backing vocals for Lamont Cranston? I'm like, are you kidding me? Yeah. Yes. And all of a sudden I was thrust into this higher level where I was watching these, the most amazing players. And I'd probably sing, you know, six songs a night. And, And if I wasn't singing, I would, you know, watch these players and how they interacted and what they did and their choices and all that. And I went from doing 6 nights a week, like 4 sets at least, you know, on the road, making $100 a week, to doing 2 nights a week, you know, singing 6 or 7 songs and making $75 a night. And I was just like, wow, mind blown. Like, okay, cool. So that was one really, that's when I'm like, okay, if I can be on this level, you know, I must be going in the right direction, you know? And then when I moved to England shortly after, I got a job as a backing singer for Rick Astley at the height of his fame in the 80s, you know? And all of a sudden, within a week of someone like discovering me, so to speak, I was at Royal Albert Hall singing backing vocals with Rick Astley. And I'm like, what the hell just happened? You know, that was really cool. And then the other most significant part of that, of my journey as far as like elevation was when the international, you know, the new age artist Yanni, who was really huge at the time, he was friends with my ex-husband, and he had been playing the Target Center in Minneapolis and asked us to come backstage. And I'd met him quite a few times, but I was never one of those people who pushed my stuff on anybody, my music or anything. I just was. Anyway, he called us to the dressing room and he said, Pamela, I'd like to talk to you. And he pulled me into a corner and he said, someone gave me your demo tape. You have a beautiful voice and I love your songwriting. We should work together. And I was like, okay. Like, I did not see that coming at all. And I ended up writing his first lyric song with lyrics, and I wrote a few more with him over the you know a period of years that went, you know, on the Billboard charts, and you know, all of a sudden it was being performed at the Taj Mahal in India and Forbidden City, and you know, I got to see it at Radio City, New York. And it was just like, it's just interesting where life can take you. You just never know. And but you kind of have to be open to it. So I know that's a really long answer, but those are some really significant moments that just were like, okay, here we go.
You mentioned working with Rick Astley at the height of his fame, and there is that difference, right, where it's like you make accomplishments, but fame is this whole other animal.
It really is. And I got to see a lot of that, you know, firsthand. And you know, and first, and for anyone who doesn't know, the British press are brutal. I mean, you're talking about, most people couldn't handle how mean they are. I mean, if they love you, that's one thing, but they can turn quick. And if they do, they're just mean, you know, all to get a story. And they make stuff up. And they're cruel, you know, and it's like to see that happen. I remember we were, you know, I think it was at that particular first thing I did with him. The next day in the paper, it was like Rick Astley was crying backstage because he has a hairy back. And it was like, so it was like we were all having a good time. It was like not true, but they just put it there. It was like there was no accountability, no, you know, nothing. And it was like, how do you handle this? But, you know, you just kind of have to, you know, and but it's just. So I didn't like that. I was just like, that's really hard. I mean, people are mean enough the way it is. You know, you go on social media and everybody just they have this power behind not being able to be seen or know who the, you know, have a face to face. And it's just anyway, the fame thing is really wonderful in certain ways, and not everybody could handle it. You know, it's I it was hard to see in some aspects, but comes with the territory.
I mean, obviously, I don't know him, but everything I can see about Rick Astley seems to indicate that he's a sensitive guy and kind.
He's so sweet and he's funny. He's funny as hell. He's funny and he's sweet. He's kind. He's just a good, as they'd say in England, a good bloke. You know, he's a good bloke. He's really a good guy. So yeah, but it's really great to see him have this other, you know, now he's still, he's doing it on his own terms now. And his new album is great. If you get a chance to check it out, I mean, I'm not usually into like more pop music, but it's beautiful. And he like wrote everything and played almost everything. I mean, he was writing stuff back in the day too that nobody didn't really tell us about that, but he's super talented guy.
Well, and the thing with Yanni, you mentioned earlier those words, revenue stream. Yeah. So you land, and Yanni was
huge at that time. Yeah.
So that had to also be sort of, you know, really affirming in terms of like, wow, this really is possible. I'm glad I didn't go to Juilliard.
Right. Right. Yeah, you know, when I started getting checks then, and it was really cool. I have to give him credit for that, because his team, their people on his team were like, just give her $5,000 and, you know, cut her out of the whatever. And he's like, no, I'm going to do the right thing and divide it, you know, for publishing. And so, you know, he sold, you know, I mean, I think it's double platinum now. And back in the day when people actually bought, you know, records and stuff. So I was able to really see what that was like. And it, again, his audience is all over the world. So we're talking everywhere. And that was an eye-opening experience. And it was wonderful, wonderful to see, you know, to actually get some, like you said, affirmation and some money, you know, for this thing that you do that a lot of times doesn't pay what everybody thinks it does. So that was really, really cool. Really, I feel really blessed and lucky about that.
And I would imagine along the way, you're also learning the way that you treat people is so utterly important in the music world.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. I don't know. I think I've done a pretty good job at that, but it is really so important to be a good person and a good human, and just, you know, and if there's somebody that you don't like or you don't mesh with, that happens, you don't have to make a big deal out of it. Just don't work with them again, you know, or just don't, you just kind of back away from it. And, but yeah, it is really important, because people do remember. People remember, how does this, you know, and so if you have a bad day or whatever, it's like, especially if you're in the spotlight, in any kind of capacity, people will say, oh yeah, I didn't, whatever, she was kind of a bitch or whatever it is, you know. It's like, well, maybe there were things going on and you don't realize it, or, but people are out, you're always under the microscope, you know? So, but it is really important to treat people well, and it shouldn't be that hard, you know, it's just being nice. So, but yeah, people remember that. I certainly remember that. But that's a great point.
How and when did you start making your own records and saying, okay, I'm going to really kind of forge my own path here?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I was always writing and recording. In my old life, as I say, we had a recording studio in our house. And my ex-husband was a engineer and mixer and all that, and really, really good at it. So I would have all these songs that, you know, someday I was trying to get a record deal or whatever it was. And I did a jingle for the United Way in Duluth, Minnesota. And one of their main sponsors was Minnesota Power. And the CEO of Minnesota Power was like, I love this. I love her voice. We need to do more with her. So all of a sudden I had a friend who lived up there who was part of the team, and I was having these meetings, and all of a sudden they invested in my career to make a record. And their goal was to pitch it to the National United Way. And that's what they did. And so I wrote most of the songs in like 4 days, and we recorded it. And it was a really cool album. Pop, kind of light pop kind of thing, a few rocker more moments, but, and it wasn't like cheesy, but it was, you know, it was thinking about people who needed, who were served by the United Way, and just all of us, you know. And Ed Russell was his name. He flew out to the national headquarters in Virginia and had a meeting, and the National United Way picked it up. And then pretty soon my band and I were being, you know, flown all over the United States doing concerts for local communities, maybe at theaters, at, you know, National United or their United Way conventions, whatever. But it built me a huge fan base really fast, and it sold a lot of records. And so all of a sudden I was on the radar of people all over the country. And that lasted about, we gave all the proceeds away for 3 years. I think we raised about $100,000, which was a nice amount of money back at that time. I was pretty proud of that, you know, to be able to do that. And then the next one, then I sort of had an audience. So started playing and just started making my own records after that, all independent until recently.
It's so interesting, right? Because, you know, you said you wanted to be a singer, and we talked about that idea of fame too, where it's like, you know, I have friends who wanted to be actors, and obviously everybody hears actor and they think, oh, that person's going to do movies or TV. But a lot of these friends of mine, you know, they do industrial films or they do commercials, and they're acting. It's not necessarily what everybody thinks about, but it's like, hey, they get to do that every day for their job.
Yeah. I mean, and that, and I try to talk to people about that all the time. You know, it is, you have to be, diversity is the key in a career, in a music career. It's not, there are a few people who sign a record deal and have it happen and are touring and that's their life, you know, but for most people it's, you can have 5-6 different things going on. You know, I'm still in. I have a Fleetwood Mac tribute I produce. I have another band called Wild Angels with my two best friends, where we do all kinds of, you know, female big singers, you know, and harmonies and that kind of thing. I have my own solo career, which is my biggest thing. You know, I have a Christmas show I'm in December. I have, you know, I'm a writer. I go to Nashville. I, you know, I mean, it's just, I'm part of a Vietnam tribute show. And I'm part of a Pink Floyd tribute, you know? So, I mean, I have all these different things going on and, you know, I'm still doing this career, in between all of it, but that all helps to pay for the things that, you know, now I have some more support and stuff, but I did all of that. I was doing 150 shows a year. And that allowed me to, you know, hire musicians and fly to Nashville or, you know, do the cover art and all that, you know? So industrial work was a big part of it, you know, but it's great because you learn every time that you do something, you learn more about your craft and who you are and how to handle this. And yeah, it's very typical. I really think that's just the modern career personally. And look, I've been able to make a living as a musician my whole life, pretty much, you know, so it, maybe you're teaching music or something. So it's all part of the whole thing.
Tell me about that period of being an independent artist. On some level today, I think most people are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but there's a learning curve there, right?
So when I first started out doing the independent thing, it's postcards and you're building your fan list and your email list. And it was expensive to mail out 1,000 postcards quarterly with all your dates on them. So this is before, you know, maybe then you had a website eventually, but in the beginning times, you know, you didn't have that kind of access till, I don't remember when it was, but, so it was expensive to do it. And, just a lot harder to reach people unless someone gave you some ink locally or whatever. So that was hard to get your message out, you know, but then when with the internet, you know, when things happened like that and we had websites and we had social media, MySpace to start with, you could start to do that. And boy, it was wonderful because it was so much cheaper. It was basically free, but you still got to keep up and you got to do this. And at the time you had to buy a website and, you know, have somebody design it and all that. But it's a lot in some ways. I mean, obviously it's a lot easier now because you can control the narrative yourself. You can get the content out there, but again, you got to create it all the time. These days it's content, you know, and it's a job.
It's so fascinating to me too, because it's like, sometimes I see videos of performers I like, and I love that they're connecting with the audience. But other times I'm like, gosh, you know, I miss the days when you didn't know what the guys in Pink Floyd looked like.
Right? I do too. I miss the mystery. I miss the mystery of it. There's a title. You know, I do. I like a little bit more accessibility and, you know, actually, you know, seeing interviews and, you know, I don't know, getting the skinny on things, but, you know, so every day it's just, we're inundated with everybody, you know, and I guess it's just the times we're living in, but yeah, I miss that too. You didn't really know what they look like, but then it was MTV that kind of changed that whole thing, I guess.
Tell me about this EP and, you know, the material that you put on this, how this kind of took shape?
Well, I was signed to Farm to Label Records and a few years ago, like three, I don't remember now, but we had one, I had one record we did on that label called Neon Lightning. And during that, we did some shows, and John Richardson, who is the head of Farm to Label, he's also the drummer in my band. And he was saying, you know, you have so many amazing songs in your catalog. It'd be really fun to try to reimagine a couple of them. And would you be up for it? I said, sure. And so him and Adam, who are my producers, I said, just go through and pick some. So they chose a few. And then I wrote a few. And one of them was The Ocean, which was my husband and I got a condo here a few years ago, and in Clearwater Beach, Florida. And that highly influenced me. You know, I've always been a water person. If you see my songs, I write a lot about lakes and rivers and tears. And, you know, I like water. I don't know if it's because I'm a Scorpio or what, but I was, would come down here and I would just walk the beach and I would see people standing at the ocean, just looking out and giving whatever it is to that power that's out there, you know, and including myself every day. I mean, they're having their conversation, or I think they save their grief, or they save whatever they need to let out. I think they save it till when they stand there, you know, and then they're like, it's a powerful thing between nature and themselves. Does that mean, I know it sounds corny, but I feel like it's so true. And I was like, I need to write this song, and it needs to be epic, just like the ocean is, you know, the different layers of it, wave after wave. And so that's where that song was inspired from. And then a couple of the other songs I'd written and were come up, some of my favorite, Needle and Vinyl was one of my favorite songs I'd ever written. It very personal to me. And Hurricane was another one. So yeah, it was just a kind of six songs. It's just sort of a combination. It was just like, well, let's just do this. And my first vinyl, which is super exciting, because when I started making records, it was in 2000, roughly. And vinyl was a thing of the past. Nobody cared anymore. So it was CDs. So I haven't even seen it yet. All my fans are posting. They got it in the mail. And because I'm stuck here and stranded in Florida, I haven't even seen it yet. So I cannot wait to get home and actually touch the first vinyl record I have. So, but that's sort of how it happened, was just that conversation and, okay, let's do this.
I'd like that when somebody goes back sometimes and revisits previous material, because I'm becoming more and more aware of the fact that most acts have new fans coming into the fold all the time. So somebody shows up late in the game, and it's like, oh, well, here's something that from the past, and then that encourages them to go back and find more.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a really cool idea, and it's really fun to freshen up things or to have a new take. One of the songs in my next life was from American Breakup, which was probably my most popular. It was the second album I ever did, and I originally, when I wrote it, it was just piano and bass and me. It was like very real quiet, whatever. And I brought it to the studio, you know, to do it with the band. And one of the guys, Tom Bukovec, who is the guitar player on everything, he just listened to the lyrics. He went, "Do you write this about somebody?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Man," he goes, "Yeah, I just think it's angry, you know." And I said, "Sure," because it was about probably the worst experience I ever had with somebody, as far as how horrible they were to me, you know. And so I said, yeah. So it was a much different take than the original, and it was just so cool and powerful. And as I was standing in the green room listening, in, you know, the control room door was open, and I was listening to the playback, they had just recorded it, and I started to get like that feeling I had back in the day about this person. I thought I had put it to bed. But this song all of a sudden was like, it restirred the emotions. And I'm like, oh my God, like, this is the way it should have been from the start. This is everything. I mean, it was a powerful moment for me. And I was like, to know that song could still make me feel these extreme emotions, I was like, this is cool. I mean, this is Wow, I was blown away by it. It was so that was like a really cool moment, just to have that feeling again after all these years. You know, I think it was 2002 it came out. So yeah, that was cool.
You've been listening to a conversation with singer-songwriter Pamela McNeil. Her latest release is a six-song EP titled Wave After Wave. You can learn more about McNeil via her official website, PamelaMcNeil.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast at KMUW.org. And we do welcome your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.